so that we can put it on the website, so other people can listen to it later, if they want to. But anyway, so the phrase that I find provocative is the mystery of enlightenment. Okay, I like that. And what is that about? And what I want to start is what it is not about. Because a lot of us are in the habit of finding excuses to feel bad about ourselves. You know, like I'm not rich enough, I'm not old enough, or I'm not young enough, or I'm not sexy enough, or I'm not thin enough, all that stuff. So you hear something about the mystery of enlightenment, and you say, oh yes, that's one more thing I can feel bad about. You know, it's like, I know nothing about enlightenment. It's a mystery to me. It's completely divorced from any of my experience. Okay? And that's not what this talk is about. Okay? really what I want to suggest is that all of us, regardless of how much experience in meditation or just in life we have, already have some experience brushing up against that experience of enlightenment. We don't stay there in the way that like a Buddha would, but it's not alien to us. And that's really interesting. And I think the way to get at this is to drill down a little bit into the actual word mystery. What exactly does that word mean? And I was reading about this, and it turns out the word mystery comes from two older Greek words. The first part, the my part, is a word about explanations or stories. And it's the basis of our words like myth and mimicry. Words like that have to do with stories one way or another. Okay. And then the other part of the word, the stir part, S-T-E-R, is about incompleteness or lack or missingness. It is the root of the word like sterility. Okay? So literally what the word mystery means is storyline lacking. It's the lack of a storyline. Okay, and that's what enlightenment is all about. You know, when you read about, you know, in the Buddha Dharma, it talks about enlightenment is this thing of being awake and not filtering your experiences through a storyline. You're directly relating to the situation, the precise situation that you're in. That's what enlightenment is about. And I think that is not necessarily so far from our experience sometimes. Okay? Probably the most obvious, I think, the most obvious time is when you are faced with some kind of a crisis or a disaster that throws you off your normal life into some kind of lost situation. Like when we had the floods last year, you remember what that was like. It was just, you didn't know what was going to go on. I mean, you didn't know what, like, where I'm going to sleep tomorrow night. You just, you know, you didn't know anything. Or like 9/11, you know, if you remember how everybody felt on that day, they just, you didn't know how much, you know, this attack, I mean, how big was it going to be? I mean, are we in danger here in Colorado? Like, nobody knew anything, you know? And in a way, of course, that's terrifying and very frightening and all that. But it also is notable because so many people reached out to each other at that time in this kind of spontaneous way and did whatever they could, you know, to be of help to each other and support each other. And that is Buddha activity, for sure. But, I mean, it's really showing us that we all, you know, can go to that place of being directly relating to the situation that we're in without having expectations about a storyline to control it, a myth to contain it. Okay. So that's provocative. But it also doesn't have to be, I don't want to just be negative about it. I mean, even in our ordinary life, I think there are times when we step away from the storyline and just act really spontaneously. Like, you know, you come across one of your friends and give them a hug. You know, and it's not because you have any kind of agenda, you know, of like, well, I want to hug this person so that, you know, she will offer to have coffee together or something. I mean, it's not that. It's just you like feel like giving her a hug, you know, and it's okay. And isn't that interesting, you know? And I suspect that if, you know, you were a Buddha, your life would be somewhat like that, you know, that... you'd have a lot of moments like that, where you're just doing things spontaneously. Okay. So I was saying, okay, there's disasters and there's ordinary spontaneity. And I think the relevant one for us here tonight is that when you think about what exactly is the point of meditation, part of it is training yourself to step away from your storylines. You know, you're sitting there on the cushion and this big, huge thought comes rolling in like a breaker on the ocean, you know, and you say, yeah, thinking, and you let it rest. You just let it fall away. And you're practicing stepping away from the storylines. You're practicing being in the present moment in the precise situation that you're in. And the precise situation that you're in this case, is meditating on the cushion and breathing. You know, that's what you're actually doing. And that's fine. And you'll kind of realize that you can connect with that. And not just that, you're also practicing what it's like to always be kind of messing up. And if you feel like the goal is not to have any thoughts at all, you're doomed. Okay? So you will have thoughts, and you get a continual opportunity to practice with those thoughts not knocking you off your seat. You let the thought drop. And whether it's a boring little thought or this huge major thought, either way, you can just let it go. So really, that's kind of what I wanted to say. And I hope some of you have, if this stimulates any of you to think of like times when you have like been with lacking a story, you know, if you've been dwelling in the mystery, that's really interesting, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think. There's so many examples. I could go on and on. I mean, One of my experiences, I've also been in the corporate world in software, and one of the things about that is you get fired a lot. I mean, I've had 10 or so times in my career that I've been laid off. I'd have to think about it, but that every single time it's like an immense thing where you just, you know, what do I do now? Feeling you've lost your story. And again, I don't mean to dwell on the negativity. It's also, you can have that same kind of thing where you are driving your car, thinking about this thing you have to do tomorrow, and you look over at the mountains, and they're just so beautiful at that moment. It just stops your thought, and you're there with the mountains, or whatever. That also is a moment of dropping the story. So, really, that's all I had to say. I was hoping to stimulate a discussion about anything that I've said or anything else. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, we had a health and well-being research group meeting on Monday.
Yeah.
The contemplation was about grasping. Mm-hmm. And this does relate to what you say. I just have to get there. I've been really struggling with my sugar addiction, really, really struggling. Uh-huh. And I feel like that is, in my life, the quintessential example of grasping. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's also the opposite of letting go of the storyline. Mm-hmm. It's an obsession in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I've been thinking, how can I approach it in a different way so that it's, you know, just struggling against it is not working.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Willpower is not working. So mm-hmm. I need another mindset. Mm-hmm. And so I'm hopeful. I'm thinking possibly that this idea of letting go of that story about mm-hmm. being obsessed with that sugar, mm-hmm. maybe that will help me step back mm-hmm. and pause.
Yeah.
Before I put my hand in the recharge. mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can watch, you can make a game out of watching yourself play this game. Mm-hmm. You know, like, so instead of you going for the sugar, you watch yourself, how is it that I feel like going for the sugar? Mm-hmm. You know, and just mm-hmm. be there. You know, like, how does that feel? Like, do I actually think it would make me feel better? Well, based on past experience, would it make me feel better? Well, no. You know, anyway, I just try to, you know, work with it. You know?
Yeah.
In my case, it does make you feel better. You feel great for 30 seconds or so.
Yeah.
You know, and then after that, you feel kind of crappy.
Yeah, but the question is, do we feel crappy because we're shaming ourselves?
Uh-huh.
Because I have struggled many, many, my whole life with that. And and as you were talking, I thought, well, what have I done? And for me, I worked with it more, I thought, about around craving. Okay. I worked with the initial craving, which is a human condition, yeah. You know. And I still have it.
Mm-hmm.
I do. And so I will eat other things instead that are less sweet or less, you know, and I'm just at peace with it now. Mm-hmm. I don't buy certain things. I mean, if, you know, mm-hmm. specific
yeah,
things.
That's the key. Yeah.
But I do have, you know, natural sweeteners, and mm-hmm. I still have them. I've gone to all ends of it, you know, where I've, you know, completely eliminated it, and then that sort of the craving goes away for a while or whatever. But how I've come in my experience is just to be in the middle way with it as much as mm-hmm. possible without bringing, from in my case, like the pure white sugar and all that, just forget it. I'm just gone with that, you know. I cannot just have a little of that.
Yeah, it's a problem. I had an experience, I have the same thing, and I'm going back and forth. I'm more where you are than where you are. But last night, and I've been, anyway, the holidays are tough, of course. So, and I do notice, and I'm guessing you probably do too, I do notice in the moment what is urging me to that. So I get present enough for that. And then I sometimes go, I don't care. I just want it.
Yeah.
And last night was one of those nights. And what's so interesting about that is I had some coconut macaroons, and I, you know, I bit into the first one, and I was present for that. I was watching television at the time. I was present for that. And then I was totally unconscious for the rest of the bag. I mean, there were only like 8 in there, but
I knew what you were.
Yeah, yes. I the bag at the end, there was one macaroon left, and I'm thinking to myself, "Well, I might as well just eat it." And I said, "No, no." But it's so fleeting.
Mm-hmm. So fleeting.
Well, I think it's really interesting that you say, you know, like you're watching TV, because that's fatal. Yeah. You know, like if you're going to do it, like just, you know,
sit and be
do it.
But it's not as fun that way.
I know. I'm an expert on this stuff.
I've done that. I might have only eaten 2.
Yeah,
it's
true.
Really sweet.
Yeah.
I was actually kind of feeling not sick.
Yeah.
Well, that's one technique I've used also is to, if there's something you want, take too much. You know, take twice as much as you. You know, like eat 2 bags, and you'll feel so terrible. It'll be like a month before ever, like, you can look at this sort of thing.
Yeah, I don't even want that last night.
I think that's the I've eaten like whole carrot cakes. I mean, it's a real addiction.
But I was pints of ice cream.
Not recently.
Yeah, right.
And then you feel sick, like an alcoholic. You feel hungover, but that doesn't mean you don't crave it 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
Okay.
Everyone seems to know.
That coma. You go through that coma.
Yeah.
And you just go, I should have done this. But then you find yourself doing it again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
Well, it's an interesting thing because it's our mind, but it's also our body.
Yes. Yeah.
Because there is a physiological thing, a shift in our chemistry that happens as a result of that. And so I notice when I can drop it for a few days,
that's right. It does get better.
There's a space that I can create. My body goes, thank you. You know, all sorts of things that are problematic for me, like go away when I'm not doing sugar.
Yeah.
So, so there's some sort of alignment. You know, so the thing about blaming, I think, is a is a big piece of it. And but the mystery for me in that is then, how do I align everything up? Because what my body really wants is balance. That's what it wants. My brain goes, no, we don't want this, you know. But the body goes, no, I really, you know, I really don't want that. That's every cell of my being knows what I really need, you know. So so I wonder if there's a way, like that meditation also provides an opportunity to really, one of the exercises in my challenge on the second day was to tune into my body, to do a scan, and to scan it every day, really. And I could even perhaps do that on a cellular level or something like that, through the process of meditation, to maybe be able to line up, say, see brain? Do you notice what's happening, brain? It's like to let my brain and my body have a conversation. And I'm wondering, you know, if that might be helpful, because I have a lot of that same stuff.
Align body-mind, isn't that kind of one of the premises or principles here?
Because it's sort of like trusting our being. Our being knows what we're doing. It's ultimately very kind, I think.
That's very, very kind. Yeah. I don't think I believe that, what you just said, but I think it, I mean, part of me knows it's probably true, and the other part of me doesn't believe that at all. And the part who doesn't believe it then won't even try to go to the place of feeling my body and see what it wants. So it's very useful for me. I think I want to try that as I'm reaching.
I think that's exactly why what she just said is why I only like it with TB. Because I have been meditating enough now that if I don't want to mindfully eat a cupcake. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And I don't even really want to make, you know,
because it's a setup.
It's a setup, and I don't really enjoy it. Just if I'm fully in my being, like you just explained, it's like I truly, it's like it knows better. It's so weird. It's like my little nephew, the first time he ate sugar, he didn't really like it. He didn't know what it was, the baby, right? Mm-hmm. But once it got in the system and starts doing what the chemical does, that set him up. I mean, I have it on video. You know, our being knows in the moment. It's it's that after feeling. It's like I want to feel that way again on some level. That numbing out.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I think that's part of the mystery of enlightenment, that you are totally tuned in, mind and body. Yeah. And you know, Bill and I have been reading that book by David Rohm. What's it called?
Your Body Knows the Answer.
Yeah.
Ooh.
And it's about focusing. That he's, you know, Eugene Gendlin started the focusing movement back in the 70s. And so David Rohm is taking it, putting it in the context of Shambhala. And, well, not specifically, but he's a Shambhala guy. And that's what it's all about, is paying attention to your body and finding those things that are there that need to be, to, I don't want to say resolved, but brought in, brought to consciousness, I guess, is that how you would say it?
Yeah.
And then understood and cared about. And so if I could make myself let go of that story of addiction and pay attention, like you were talking about, you know, what is, or Susan, was, somebody was saying, what is that reason in the moment that I'm really wanting that thing, if I could really stop and pay attention.
Yeah, yeah. That creates a space. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the space.
To happen.
That's, yeah. That's what I was saying about the craving. Be with the craving.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And in a few days, if you don't act on the craving, or as Pema Chodron says, if you don't scratch the itch, you get to be with what's under the itch. Yes. And
Yeah.
I think one issue is that for a lot of people like me, like when I hear someone say, you know, give you the advice, well, be with your body, be in your body. Mm-hmm. For me, that's one more way to beat myself up, like I said at the beginning, because I really don't know how to do that. Like, as a fat man, I mean, it's obvious I have lost the ability to understand when I've had enough. Uh-huh. You know, I just, that gauge is broken, you know. I think that's true. And so I feel like, oh, you know, yes, I should be in my body, but I can't really do that because my sensor is broken or something. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of train of thought I have. Yeah. And I think the way to get past that is actually what we were talking more about through meditation. Mm-hmm. It's just like, be present now and see. I mean, it sounds so obvious, you're like, but to kind of see what your situation actually is. Mm-hmm. And that can slowly lead you to understanding that, yes, I have eaten too much and I feel a little bit ill right now. You know, and that's news. That's something I didn't know before. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That constant attention is the challenge.
Yeah.
And just in everything. But I think what I found, I can't do it every minute.
No.
In every situation. So I have to be selective. So I'm trying to do sugar craving is my moment. Sugar craving and driving.
Yeah. Well, that touches on a point, too, that I want to just touch on, which is, we think of our ability to, our tendency to make storylines as kind of like, we're presenting it here in this kind of negative light, you know? But that also is part of our wisdom. I mean, that's how we get through our lives. That's how we survive in the corporate world, is to some extent, simplify our lives by participating in these kind of collective myths, these collective storylines about, like, what's going on in this company, you know? But then we take it too seriously. We believe it too much, you know. And like, when the time comes to stop it and drop it, we can't, you know. And that's I think is the tragedy. And that's what meditation is good for, to help
and
you.
And so then you start thinking it's real.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But my point is that it's not like evil.
No.
I mean, it's one way. It's a manifestation of our wisdom, is the ability to strategize by using storylines to carry us through a very complicated world. Mm. To some extent, but then we do too much.
We fixate on it, on things, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to talk about the word enlightenment.
Yes.
Because that's kind of a charged, can be kind of a charged word. I guess in our conversations here, for me, it's something about wisdom. Mm-hmm. Something that already exists in each and every one of us. So I'm just thinking out loud. Enlightenment, wisdom, and then if kindness is a demonstration of wisdom, then it has something to do with kindness. So I don't know, those three words, if I had them on three pieces of paper, I don't know what I'd do with them. And is one more important than the other, or which comes first, or I'm not sure. But that's kind of what I'm playing with now. That was my challenge today, is about that there's an inherent wisdom in kindness. Hmm. That somehow the act of kindness is a demonstration on my part of having a deep understanding of something, which is true. Does that sound good? Mm-hmm. And so therefore I'm enlightened. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The moment I notice you and think about your little girl, you know, and sort of think of her in this loving way, I'm thinking about her with your husband and how that must be going tonight. I'm thinking about your poor husband. But anyway, but in that act, then it's like a domino effect then. I'm kind, and therefore I'm aware, and therefore I'm enlightened. I don't know. I'm curious what other people think about what enlightenment is.
You're having a moment that he was of enlightenment. I think that for me, I took from what you said that one way to look at enlightenment is the absence of storyline, in other words, the direct experience. And that was very helpful for me. And I can see how, if you could have those moments, one right after the other, then that's what the life of an enlightened being might be like. Can't really even fathom how do you live without a story, but apparently it's possible.
What happens though when you are grasping for those moments? Because I feel like that's where I am. I was in the corporate world and decided to become a stay-at-home mom, which is such a gift. But I found all of these passions and callings that are sort of buzzing around all the time, and I don't know what to do with them. And so I find meditation and, you know, reading spiritual literature and connecting with people. I feel like I'm almost obsessed with the result, which is not what it's about, but it's... Mm. It's like there's an addiction to getting answers, I feel like. And so in doing that, then I'm not in the moment. I'm looking, even in meditation, I always find, one of the first times I did it, I had this like epiphany, like I heard a voice. And I still want that. It felt so like connected that I feel like I walk into meditation wanting that. And so you know, I do the whole let the thoughts go and let the thoughts go, but I don't get that moment, so I feel maybe I did something wrong. Maybe I just wasn't focused enough. It's it's such a struggle because I don't have, I mean, I have a 2-year-old, but that's kind of non-intellectual, so I feel like the part of me that's not in the workforce is searching for this, and I guess it's enlightenment. I feel like that's what it is, but the search is making me distracted from what I think I really need to be doing, I guess.
Well, I think that what Eric was saying earlier, that when the storyline is gone, the way you are is different.
Right.
You know, like when you see the mountain, or you see a rainbow, or maybe you see an accident, or you see, there's stories of people, you know, there's a little kid in the road and a car coming, that's the thoughts stop and you just do.
Yeah.
But it's just being present without thoughts. You can act, but without actually having to thinkingly process it. Those things happen all the time.
Yeah.
That we have those moments. We don't pay attention to them.
Yeah. Or for me, it'll happen and then all of a sudden there's this underlying expectation. This is, I'm going to feel this again or I'm next time.
Oh, yeah.
I think about it too much.
Sounds like the sugar.
Yeah.
Yeah, but really sweet meditation.
Like yeah.
I want that more.
But where's that voice? You know?
I think the meditation is, I mean, the idea that you hear a lot is that if you meditate, it's good. if you get up and you think it was a lousy meditation, it's still good.
Yeah.
And if you get up and you think you had great meditation, it's still good.
Yeah.
And I guess the idea is that by just doing it, and after a while you realize it doesn't make any difference. You know, I have these, you know, you have these moments when the world is amazing, and you have moments and you go, what a waste of time. But it works.
It works, but it doesn't work in the way that you kind of imagined.
You can't work with that.
I can't, because it's kind of inexpressible, but I mean, I think like all of us, we go into meditation with a particular image of what it will look like when it comes through the other side, you know, and that's not true.
Right.
That's just a dream that you have that is not true.
Yeah. And then time will show you that. Because I can really relate to that.
Yeah.
When I was in my 20s, it was the same thing. Like, you know, I was thinking maybe I was going to be in a monastery. Like, I just wanted...
Yeah. Connection.
And I probably bought and got rid of literally, like, 500 spiritual self-help type books, and mm-hmm. in the last 30 years, like since I was like 18, because I had one experience.
Yeah.
But I think, and what I've read about others is that mm-hmm. that we have those experiences, and in my case, I had that experience to get me on the path, and then sometimes it does feel like an obsession.
Yeah.
And but what I keep hearing in these, and here in Shambhala in particular, is that, which has been very helpful, even though I meditated for many years and it was very similar, and I learned a lot of the same things, but I really like how they talk about the gentleness and the not expecting and to let the thoughts be there. And as I've been practicing that particular, very particular piece, it does, it just, that brings enlightenment. That opens the door for the light to come in.
Yeah.
It's not something we can do.
Yeah.
It's not something my mind is going to ever grasp. It's it's a, you know, you were talking about all those now moments coming together, or you talked about having those enlightened moments, but really it's all just accessible in now. And so the mind's going to do its dance, and then my job, if there is one, is to just be with that, observe that.
Yeah, it's one of the, I think, one of the most forgiving things that has drawn me to this particular practice is, and I'm sure it's true in other practices as well, is I get to embrace how I am. Mm-hmm. You know, so I get to embrace that I crave sugar. I get to embrace that I feel crappy today. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that I actually do it, but I at least appreciate the concept, and that kind of, that's a kindness to myself, just to do that, and notice, oh look, I'm obsessed with wanting to get that experience again.
And if you've spent your life hating yourself, that possibility is just radical, you know, that you could actually say that, you know, it's okay. I mean, the way I am is actually...
really?
Human, and that's there's nothing wrong with that. It's by saying it's, there's nothing wrong with that, I don't mean that you can't improve some of the things you do and all that, but but that, you know, in Shambhala they talk about basic goodness. There is this level at which you're fine, you know, and you just have this stuff that is kind of messing you up, but at the basic level you're fine.
Very funny about this is this also points to the other, one of the tenets of Buddhism is that everything is impermanent, including who we are.
Right.
I mean, there really isn't any self, because we have this picture of me, you know, this unchanging me, who, you know, tonight craves some sugar, tomorrow morning has sworn off sugar for the rest of my life. And you know, every moment I'm different. I'm hanging on so tight to this. This thing is just flying everywhere.
What?
Essentially, what you're hanging on to is your mental image of that thing without really knowing, seeing its reality.
Yeah, that's why accepting what I am
sort
of helps, makes me realize that, wait a minute, it's like it here.
Some authors said that, we should love our addictions because they point to... you know, they're a pseudo for connection with the divine. So, beating up ourselves is just part of the same abusive cycle that an abuser uses for someone. You know, it's just some release, but it doesn't quite get to the core. So you're always back to trying to find it, and there's no, and it does lead to the mystery. And the mystery is that you don't grasp those things, and there's a sort of peace of mind, you know, that can come around from doing that, and I'm definitely not there at the moment. So this is just an intellectual exercise, but I understand it when I'm there.
What if you say that they embrace your addictions because they point to the connection to the divine? Is that what you said?
Or desire for the connection of the divine? Isn't that what they say?
Yeah, it's something like that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure there's any.
Yeah, I just misheard.
That's essentially it. Yeah.
The word that keeps coming up for me, especially when you began your description of sort of this openness is portals. I was thinking about Harry Potter, you know, and there'd be all these portals, which were just opportunities, like accessible somethings in the moment that you could, you know, walk into a wall and all of a sudden you'd be in a different place, or you'd get on a train and it would take you somewhere where it was mystical, you know. So what is that? You know, so that whole idea of space to me is so important, because that stuff is happening all the time and I don't see it. Mm-hmm. It's happening all the time around me and I just don't see it. Because I'm, you know, with the, you know, oh, depressed, or, you know, or whatever I got to share, you know, whatever the thing is. And but there's portals like all over. And maybe each of us is like a portal.
Yeah.
You know, maybe if I have a relationship with you, and that all of a sudden something shifts inside of me and I understand things in a different way. That's why I want to be connected, because sometimes with humans it's like, oh, I really, you know. I like the animals, like the dog, the dog, and the cat. I can, it's like that connection seems so easy, and with humans, this is so painful sometimes. But maybe if I could see them as a portal, I'm a portal, we're all portals for each other, or something like that, I don't know.
There's an experience this is reminding me of, and it sort of builds on what you said, that I'm trying to relate to this, which is, I was reading, I don't know, I think I was reading Time, or I was reading something online. It was about, I think it was about Ukraine, and there were bodies and, you know, decimated people in this picture who were soldiers. And I looked at this picture, and I all of a sudden had this, what felt to me like a portal moment, or a... kind of an epiphany of horror. I realized how numb I have become to this thing, and I all of a sudden, you know, thought to myself, how is it possible that we could do this to each other? Mm-hmm. In a way that I hadn't experienced before. And then, of course, so as I'm thinking about that moment, there was the moment of pure sort of horror, and then there was the storyline that came on top of that, which is, how could we be so asleep to this, and I should never support anything that has anything to do with war and aggression. And then I started getting myself all worked into this tizzy. But that moment felt very much like a portal. A portal moment where I just had this realization of something that was intellectual for a long time, which is, oh yes, war is bad. And oh yes, And then I felt this... And I can't even imagine what it would be like to be on a battlefield and be in that situation. Talk about a portal.
Yeah, we're going to... Any last words? We're going to have to...
Yeah, thank you all. That was really
interesting. Thanks, Eric.
Good. Thank you.
Great topic. Oh, so we have announcements. Let's see.